Hey there, and welcome to another episode of Conversations with Leaders. I'm Sam. Inspiration is one of the best ways to transform. Conversation with Leaders is a bi-weekly interview with industry key players, CEOs, financial authors, and professional money managers worldwide. Get valuable insights from people who've seen it all. Please remember that this podcast is intended for educational and informational purposes. Stay tuned for additional disclosures at the end of today's episode. Now, let's get started. Hello everyone, hope we are all doing well. We'll get started very shortly. Hope you're looking forward to our space today. We're going to cover things all crypto, but in the meantime, feel free to ask any questions that you like in response to the tweet. Feel free to send us a DM as well. We've already got some great questions which we're going to go through. What are we going to discuss? Well, we'll talk about the recent bull run. We'll talk about the Bitcoin ETF, the upcoming halving. We'll also talk about what projects excite our guests. We're going to cover it all. We're joined by some of the biggest titans in the crypto field, and I'll get them to introduce themselves shortly. But a few things to discuss before we get into all of that. This space is for educational purposes only and is not investment advice. Past performance is not an indication of future results. All trading carries risks. Please do not risk capital you cannot afford to lose. As I mentioned, feel free to ask any questions throughout. Give us a retweet, give us a like, give us a follow. We're going to keep an eye on those DMs as well. Today, as my co-host, I'm joined by Simon Peters. Simon, first of all, how are you doing? Tell us a little bit about your role at eToro.
Hi, Sam. Good to be here. So my role at eToro is primarily as a account manager looking after our diamond level customers. I'm also a spokesperson for eToro covering crypto.
Amazing. Well, look, great to have you with us here today. We're also joined, honestly, I'm so excited about this lineup we've got. We've got Pedro de Noronha, we've got Francisco Gordillo and Andrew Rosner, plus a very, very, very special guest who has just joined us as well, our CEO at eToro, Yoni Assia. In the meantime, go check his pinned tweet on his eToro account just to let us all know how long he's been involved in this world. But before we get to you, Yoni, Pedro, let's start off with yourself. First of all, how are you? And can you tell us a little bit about yourself as well?
Morning, Sam. Morning, Simon. Great to be here. Listen, I think I have a not traditional way of getting into Bitcoin. Unlike most of the people here, I started my relationship with Bitcoin shorting it. I just got lucky enough to short the top of the 2017 bubble and rode it all the way from 20,000 to around 5,000-6,000 until Drew, who's a speaker also on this spaces, managed to orange pill me. And since then I reverted my position and it's been doing great. So, I'm totally orange pilled and I spent a large part of my time trying to evangelize people and orange peel them so that they see the revolution that we're in the midst of.
Amazing. Pedro, great to have you with us. Francisco, same question to you. First of all, how are you? And a little bit about yourself.
Hello, everyone. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation. I got into Bitcoin in 2012. At the beginning, I came across the term and it sort of, I didn't pay too much attention to it. At some point, I downloaded the white paper and, I didn't fully understand it. I knew there was something there, but couldn't really grasp it. So I started studying and at some point I had some sort of epiphany. And I convinced myself that this was the direction in which the world had to advance. So at the beginning an intellectual curiosity became a passion and a way of living and then a business. And as of today, I manage a fund I have co-founded in 2019 with Arne Bergen, who's a very well-known Norwegian traditional asset manager. And I am as Polish and as happy to be here as I was in 2012 when I met when I first moved into Bitcoin. So I'm very glad to be here with all of you.
Thank you, Francisco. Great to have you on. Andrew, same question. How are you? And a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, hi. So I apologize. I'm not sure how my internet is, but am I coming through clearly?
Loud and clear for me.
All right, beautiful. So I first off, thank you for the invitation. Glad to be here. My primary business is domain names, basically all facets of the secondary market for high-end domain names. I've been in that market for quite a long time. And in 2011, I sold a domain name. I won't mention for who, but it was one of the early developers in Bitcoin. And sold it for $250,000. He called me 2 weeks later and said, listen, I'm taking all of this money and I'm buying this thing called Bitcoin and I'm buying mining rigs and all this. And I couldn't have done this without you. And I want you to get some. And I have a high propensity for, you know, risk, educated risk. And he said, you know, just get some. And so I wanted to. I was a technologist, the least technological technologist alive. And so when he started talking about open source wallets and all this that I needed to get the Bitcoin, it went over my head. And I said, look, you know, the future of money I'm in, but I just can't, I don't know about how to get it. So it took me another 6 months, and it was around 2012. I was very lucky in that I lived in town. And a whole bunch of the real OG Bitcoin guys were down there setting up exchanges because Panama at the time was kind of like Wild West for Bitcoin. The government was like, look, do whatever you want, set up an exchange, no problem. You can get banking relationships. And so you had Eric Voorhees and Roger Ver and Charlie Schramm, and you had, it was a whole contingent of a lot of guys that were down there. And so there was Bitcoin meetups, and I, you know, finally one of the guys that worked for Charlie Schramm actually helped set me up. I got my first Bitcoin, and you know, really the rest is history. I had one major hiccup when it hit $750. The same guy that got me into Bitcoin got me out of it. He made me trade all my Bitcoin for gold. And it was when it hit $1,200 that I quickly realized my mistake. I got back in. I never got back to the number of coins I had, but lost a lot in the ICO markets and the shit coining. I will say up front that I've gone full circle from, you know, pure Bitcoin to full shitcoin to absolute 100% Bitcoin maximalist at this point. So that's me in a nutshell.
Amazing. Well, look, great to have you on. And it's just mental, isn't it? Thinking back to the days when it was trading in the low hundreds and now we're in and around 70,000. Please do make sure if you're listening to follow all.
I think it was trading at 12 cents on the day that I first learned about Bitcoin. When the guy called me 2 weeks after selling his domain, I think it was 12
wow.
cents.
Wow, wow, wow. We are going to be joined by our CEO, Yoni Ashar, very shortly. I'll introduce him once he gets involved. But for those that are joining late or watching this on the recording or listening to this on the recording, we're also going to upload it to the podcast Digest and Invest. If you type that in on any podcast host, you'll be able to find all of our episodes there, so do check that out. Let's get into the questions then. Pedro, you're the first name that I can see, so I'm going to come to you first of all, and we're going to talk about the ETF to begin with. So first things first, how are you feeling about it? Are you encouraged by the early developments and anything else that's come to your mind at the moment?
Quite honestly, I'm blown away. I think the most important thing that people don't really grasp is that we went up until 2023, where maybe 1% of the investor community would bother doing the work to own Bitcoin. It was complicated. You have to open an account in an exchange. You have to transfer money there. You have to do the KYC and so on. Nowadays, from January 11th onwards, all you need is a brokerage account. So your addressable market went from 1% of the Western civilization to 80%. That's an 80x. And in the meantime, 1% of the population has 97% of the Bitcoin, whereas 80% now has around 1% of the Bitcoin. So these curves are crossing, and at a time where we have a halving less than a month away, we, for the first time ever, got an all-time high before a halving, something that Francisco, who's speaking, told me about a couple of months ago, and I thought, wow, that would be incredible, and it happened. So I think the ETFs are a game changer. Now, on the long term, are ETFs the smart way to own Bitcoin? I don't think so. But I think they're a great entry point for someone to first experience what Bitcoin is, and then eventually get educated into self-custody and owning your own Bitcoin. Because at the end of the day, if you own an ETF, you're only betting on price appreciation, which granted is the main motivation for most people. But what is important here is you can be your own bank. And that's the technological revolution that Bitcoin is. So I think Bitcoin ETFs are a game changer that is currently still being severely mispriced by the market.
As a question I have for you guys is around investment style and strategy with the ETFs now available. Has this changed for you?
Not at all for me. I own Bitcoin outright, not ETFs.
Yeah, same for me. I do have some exposure to the ETFs, just because, you know, there's a certain portfolio, you know, in equities and whatnot. And at this time, you know, Bitcoin's going to be the fastest rate in the horse, so it makes sense. But generally speaking, I would always advise primarily to own Bitcoin, the underlying asset.
Yeah, thank you. Francisco, I'll come to you. And then obviously, if anyone else has anything they want to follow up with, they can do. The inflows that we've seen, you know, as Petro was alluding to, have just been insane, haven't they, since mid-January. Do you think this continues? But also, does it need to continue for price to remain at the current levels? I mean, sentiment-wise, are we in a good place at the moment?
Well, I think, as Petro was saying before, the addressable market that can invest in a relatively easy way is now there, whilst before it wasn't. You know, the US ETFs are only the beginning. We are seeing movements in that direction in the UK, in Hong Kong, and this is going to trickle throughout the whole financial system worldwide. But what that implies is that we are going to be seeing a wall of capital, a tsunami of capital in the way of opening positions and having exposure to Bitcoin. This has never happened before, and it sort of takes place at the point in time in which you have the convergence of, as Pedro was saying, the halving, you know, we increased the interest through the ETFs and all the sales forces from BlackRock and the Fidelities of this world, etc. At the same time that we are most probably going to sooner or later see a reversion of the interest rates and the inversion of liquidity. Liquidity is going to come back in the market, which is going to be very positive for risk assets. Of course, Bitcoin is one of those. So I think this is just the beginning. I think nobody thought we would see initial inflows beat those of gold, of the gold ETF when it was launched back at the beginning of the century so quickly. And I think this is just an indication of what is coming. I think we're going to be mind blown. I don't think anyone is sufficiently bullish for what is coming, and we are at the perfect point in time to get exposure to this asset, those that don't have it. And I think this is sustainable, and it has legs, and it's going to go very, very far.
And if I can complement on what Francisco is saying, right now, since January 11th, we had roughly 8 billion of net inflows into ETFs when you factor in the redemptions from Grayscale. I mean, 8 billion of inflows created 400 billion plus of market value. That's a multiplier effect of 50. And you're assuming that the Bitcoin that the ETFs got were the low-hanging fruit, the paper hands that were out there in the market. So now we're getting into the hodlers, the diamond hands, the people who will not let go of their Bitcoin at this kind of low prices. So we're getting into a situation where a wall of money, as Francisco says, is going to hit people who, many of them, have opted for a Bitcoin standard. Many of them just do not want to get back into the fiat system. So this is going to be incredibly interesting.
Yes, I'd like to add something to what Pedro is saying, which I think I obviously agree, and is that we are seeing a very small number of Bitcoins in exchanges ready to be traded, and Bitcoin has a relatively narrow free float or small free float. So when that excess of demand hits the market, and obviously the paper hands have been washed out, and the vast of the remaining holders are those that have opted out of the fiat standard, as Pedro was saying. This is just, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen, but it's going to be world-changing, I think.
I think one of the things that's remarkable to me is, you know, sort of the Jeff Booth thesis of like, look, Bitcoin is just repricing the world. Every decision that every single person makes, whether it's financial or otherwise, is never made in a vacuum. Everything in this universe is relative. And so every time that somebody does make a financial decision, they may be ignorant of Bitcoin. They may not like it. They may whatever. But at some point, they simply cannot ignore that they're making a decision in the face of a superior asset. And so over time, there is no choice but increased allocation to Bitcoin, whether that's from a bond fund, whether that's from a fixed income fund, whether that's from an individual. I repeat, I've been in Bitcoin for 13 plus years. I finally, after being, I mean, I'm the guy that orange-pilled Pedro, as he said, I'm an advocate. And I've never been able to get my father into Bitcoin, despite countless hours of education. And just this past week was the first time I finally got him to buy his first Bitcoin. And the ETF was the trigger. It, in his mind, was the first time that Bitcoin wasn't a scam. Bitcoin was a real asset. Bitcoin was investable. And so I think that as you see Bitcoin repricing everything, and the ETF gives this signal of approval from, you know, the mainstream, and it opens up the door for people that may have wanted to but were unable to invest, I think that we've just expanded the scope of that repricing exponentially broader and faster. So I have to believe, I flip-flop about where we are in this cycle, but I have to believe that we are just incredibly incredibly early, and the ETF basically acted like a first halving before the halving.
I suppose on the subject of halvings, it's coming up in 25 days' time now. What are your thoughts around that? Does it feel different this time around, the years gone by?
There's no question it's different, right? It's we've never had a bull run like this before the halving. We've never made a new all-time high before the halving. We now have this massive new channel by which, you know, a lot of the halving price action, you know, would be, let's say, disrupted by a Coinbase outage, right? That was like the historical signal that we've entered a bull market. And that has a lot less effect when people are gaining exposure through the ETF. We don't have the volume of shitcoinery happening that was going on with FTX and Binance in the last cycle and the cycle before that. There's a lot that is very different this cycle, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm with you there. Sorry, Francisco, just to we'll come back to you very shortly. Yoni, I think, has just joined us. I've just sent him a request to join as a speaker. So Yoni, if you can hear this, do accept him and we'll get you on board. Just before Yoni does come on, for those listening now, how do we feel about Bitcoin at these levels? If you think that we can go to 100K this year, with the emoji, hit that 100. If you don't put thumbs down, I just want to get a feel for sentiment in the room at the moment. So for those that don't know how to do the emoji, click the heart button at the bottom. I'm seeing a few of these come through. Relatively mixed opinion, but I suppose there's more 100s there. Just while we wait for Yoni, then Francisco, same question to yourself. How are you feeling?
Well, I think, Drew was laying it out beautifully well. But I also think that there's a major difference at this point, and is that, you know, whilst as before, the halving did have a lot of psychological impact because the demand in the market was driven by the retail tranche, let's call it like that. We are not going to see that complemented by the institutional side of life, let's call it. But for me, what is very important is that it coincides, the halvings usually coincide with the reversion of the liquidity cycle. I mean, because Bitcoin started in January 2009, just right after the debt crisis, there's some sort of overlapping, if you want, or coordination between liquidity and the halvings every 4 years. And we are just not now going to enter into a period of time in which liquidity is going to come back into the market. And when that happens, it obviously trickles down the risk curve and ends up in risk assets. And that's going to be, very, very bullish. So I think that on top of the previous factors for the old halvings, we have an additional set of circumstances that make this probably, I don't know if it's going to be the most interesting sort of halving of all, but it's going to be up there with 2013, I think.
Yeah, certainly exciting times, isn't it? Andrew, I'll come to you, and then Pedro, Francisco, feel free to join in as well. I mean, we could be accused here of getting a little bit greedy when we start talking about an Ethereum ETF and, adding that to the crypto space. Does that feel inevitable? Does it feel like it needs to happen soon? Or actually, can we take a step back and say, you know what, it happens when it happens, whatever will be, will be.
I stated it up front. I am a Bitcoin maximalist. I was in the Ethereum ICO. I contributed quite a substantial amount of Bitcoin to the Ethereum ICO, regrettably. But I think that, unlike maybe other Bitcoin maximalists, I actually am glad that there is an alternative space, almost like a sandbox, where a lot of great ideas are being, good and bad ideas are being experimented on. And I think that over a 10-year period of time of battle testing, we will find out what features some of these coins, including Ethereum, have that may be functional for Bitcoin on a layer one or a layer two, addition. After 10 years of battle testing, after finding out if there's actually a demand, a real world market fit for any of these features. And I'm sure there are. But I find that this stuff is dilutive, both to the individual as well to the market. And I think that Ethereum, whether it's a security today or not, it certainly was at inception. And so I don't encourage the approval of an Ethereum ETF, quite honestly. And I think that, anybody who truly believes in Bitcoin and understands Bitcoin and wants to own Bitcoin, not just for the speculative reason of number go up, but also because of the fundamental purposes for which it exists, for which it was created, and for what the long-term horizon may promise. I don't think that an Ethereum ETF is constructive to the market.
Amazing, Andrew. I really appreciate the that point of view. Let us know in the chat if anyone agrees, disagrees, thumbs up, thumbs down. Yoni, do we have you live and direct from the mountains? If so, let us know how you're doing and let us know how you feel about the crypto world at the moment.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, we can. Yes.
Hi, everyone. I'm on a mountain in France skiing. But the team asked me to join and give my opinion on what's going on. So thank you, everyone, for joining and listening. Generally, I'm what's considered a crypto conservative. I've always been a Bitcoin zealot. I've been a Bitcoin maximalist at some point, though I did open my heart to Ethereum, smart contracts, and blockchain a while ago. I think these are definitely exciting times where the perception of Bitcoin, the brand awareness of Bitcoin, the institutional demand and acceptance of Bitcoin with the Bitcoin ETF is at a level that we've never seen before within the crypto industry. It's been more than 10 years since we launched Bitcoin trading on eToro.
I think we've lost Yoni there to the mountains. Hopefully he's okay and he's not skiing, but hopefully he will also be back as well. Francisco or Pedro, any view yourselves on the Ethereum ETF?
Sure. Listen, I'm like Drew. I'm a Bitcoin maximalist. To be quite honest, I don't understand Ethereum. I still think they're looking for what they want to be. And in terms of the possible Ethereum ETF, I see a problem with it, which is proof of stake. So if an Ethereum ETF exists, they will get an incredible amount of power over the proof of stake, and eventually they will control the network. I'm not a proof of stake apologist. I think proof of work is the revolution that makes Bitcoin be what it is. And getting back just quickly to the halving question that you asked, you know, right now on average, the ETFs are taking 10 times the daily mine supply. So post April 21st or whenever the halving is, they're going to be taking 20 times the daily mining supply. So there's a demand shock that happens there, which should be positive to price. And then it's also important to notice that after this coming halving, it's the first time ever that in history we've had an asset that is harder than gold from a stock to flow perspective. Right now, Bitcoin is around as hard as gold. After the halving, it's going to be twice harder than gold. So we're comparing a $1.4 trillion asset with one that is a $14 trillion asset, and it's going to be twice as hard. So just if Bitcoin is, and our worst case scenario is Bitcoin is just better at being gold than gold. So you have close to a 10x there, just as a worst case scenario. And if then you have cherries on top of the cake, which we can do layer twos, layer threes. And, you know, as Drew was saying, you know, what I like about Ethereum is that whatever is being built there or on Solana are ideas that then can be, after battle tested, they can be adopted by Bitcoin. A bit like Instagram did to Snapchat. Whenever Snapchat had a good idea, they just took it from them, because they have the most secure network. So there'll be people who will want to replicate those ideas, and it's all open source anyways. So I'm, you know, both on Ethereum, don't have a very positive view, and on Bitcoin, I think on the halving, the position is clear.
Yes, I have a bit of a divergent opinion. Well, first of all, if I'm a maxi of something, it's of individual sovereignty. That's why I'm a very strong proponent of self-custody, you know, going back to your previous question. But having said that, I do think that Bitcoin and Ethereum are complementary in one way or another. Whether if you want to call one a sandbox of the other or not, well, you know, that's up for the details. But I think having an alternative sort of consensus algorithm, having something which has a higher level of plasticity where you can sort of develop ideas more easily and stuff like that, adds value to the space. Now, having said that, I'm going to the original question, which is the Ethereum ETF. I think that the Ethereum ETF is inevitable. And there was a very interesting thread yesterday from the head of legal of Grayscale analyzing the situation with the Ethereum ETF filing with regards to maybe not having as many contacts as they had prior to the approval of the Bitcoin ETF, and whether it's Ethereum is a security or not, the relationship between the futures ETF and the potential spot one, et cetera, et cetera. And the willingness by Grayscale to sort of battle it out in court, which is what gave the, which was the catalyst for the approval of the Bitcoin ETFs. And I think the Ethereum ETF is going to happen no matter what. It's inevitable. Whether if it happens in May, in August, or later down the line, that I don't know. But I think it's coming. Now, as of there, I have a lot of difficulty seeing ETFs of other L1s, at least, being approved, although time will tell. Anyhow, I think Bitcoin is going to raise all votes. That side is going to raise all votes. Ethereum is going to accompany Bitcoin. We'll see who leads moving forward. And I think that from an institutional perspective, if they solve the staking situation with regards to a potential Ethereum ETF, the fact that institutions may have a yield-generating asset is something which may prove very beneficial with regards to activating appetite from those large institutions. However, as I said, I see a future in which both of them prosper and are complementary down the line.
Question for you, Francesco. If you feel an ETF or an Ethereum ETF will be approved, how do you think that will affect the price of these? Do you think it will affect it in the same way? Like we have seen with Bitcoin, for example, you know, there's a lot of excitement around the spot ETF on Bitcoin and the price has responded. Do you think we'll see the same on Ethereum?
I think both assets, Ethereum and Bitcoin, are sitting at the capsule of a SpaceX, of the DragonX, of demand. I mean, they are going to go absolutely ballistic, but so is the rest of the asset class. We will see when the situation reverses in the future, and we'll see how long it takes. You know, what of those assets that have alternatively also pumped remain or survive, as happened in 2017 and 2018 and all that? Because I think there is a greed meme that leads the retail demand in the whole space that gets washed out every couple of years. And that greed must not be underestimated. And I think it's going to, as I said before, raise all boats. So we are also super bullish on the Ethereum price. Yes, together with Bitcoin, I think those two assets are going to sort of provide the new ground for a reordering of the world, actually.
Interesting. Yoni, I think you're back with us. How do you feel about the Ethereum ETF, the potential? Do you feel it's inevitable? Is it exciting you?
I wasn't extremely excited even from the Bitcoin ETF. And the reason is, I think a big part of the Bitcoin, Ethereum, blockchain ethos is that we want people to learn how to own their own assets and not go through a wrapper that is archaic in nature, that trades on archaic systems, which are not blockchain based. I understand why for institutional demand, for pension funds, for people who are running asset managers, maybe with still an Excel and paper, it's important and we welcome them into the industry. But I think eventually the rise of crypto blockchain assets is the ability of participants to actually trade and invest in the actual assets and understand how to use them and how to use blockchain and smart contracts versus being wrapped. So I'm not necessarily that excited by an Ethereum ETF. I do think there's a big challenge there because of staking. So there's a question, a real regulatory challenge that doesn't exist with a Bitcoin ETF. And I think Bitcoin has been confirmed as a commodity in US securities markets for a while now versus Ethereum, where we're hearing rumors that it hasn't. So I think it will take time. It might happen. I don't know to say whether it's inevitable because it's traditional financial markets accepting new digital assets. But I do think the holy grail of the industry is people actually using wallets, using Web3, understanding how to send and receive crypto assets.
Yeah, thank you, Yoni. And on the halving, which of course is not too far away, how do you feel about that? I mean, you've been involved with Bitcoin since the very beginning, really, haven't you? So this is the fourth one you've seen. Is this any different? How are you feeling?
I think, you know, this is my first crypto rally, maybe even fifth and the fourth halving. which I'm seeing. I think, you know, if you look at the history post halving, there's usually a rally like six, but those six, I think, to 9 months after the halving. This time we got a sneak peek to it even before. I think because everybody's expecting another super cycle of crypto. So definitely people are excited about the fact that the halving is going to change the dynamics and supply and demand. And people are anticipating this and sort of stacking stats, which is always a smart thing to do if you don't have enough Bitcoin as of now. So I don't think we'll necessarily see an inflection point. I see, you know, there's a lot of buy the rumors, sell the news. So I don't think it's that day something goes up. I might be wrong. I think it's a process of just demand increasing from natural demand, from demand on platforms like Coinbase and eToro, to demand on the Fidelity and the BlackRock ETFs, and supply is happening. So I think those dynamics are quite obvious.
Yeah, I'm with you. Francisco, Pedro, or Andrew, any further comments on the halving yourselves? How are we feeling about it at the moment?
I would just say, while I mostly agree with Yoni, I think that I actually disagree that people were, or people are, front running the halving. I think that what we're seeing with this sort of, let's call it, early bull run is the demand effect from the ETF. I think that ultimately, really what we saw is almost an identical function on the supply and demand relationship in Bitcoin as the 2013 halving. Now, in the 2013 halving, it's in essence, you know, a supply crunch as opposed to a demand shock. But mathematically, the effect is the same. The function is the same. And so I think really, actually, the ETF approval and subsequent inflows that we've seen acted in a materially same or similar nature to a halving event. And so I think that actually, as opposed to, you know, a front running of the price from the supply shock of the coming halving, I think that it is a function of the demand shock from the ETF approval. And so I'm really, really interested. And if I wish I was smarter and could figure this out, but I'm really interested about how these two events, the ETF approval, which in essence acts as a first halving, and the actual halving, which is in what, two or three weeks, how those two things, I have to believe that's not a linear relationship and that there's a compounding there. And maybe there's somebody smarter than me who understands that better. But I think that if you look at it as a halving event, the ETF approval, and then you look at the coming halving event, and then you compare hodler behavior based on price thresholds, I think that you're going to be able to fairly accurately assess where we're headed. But I'm not smart enough to do that.
Well, you sound it to me anyway, if that's any consolation. Pedro, anything for you to add there?
Not really. I mean, I just think, as Drew said, we just had a demand shock and we're going to have a supply shock less than 3 months later. And I mean, in an asset that is as rigid as they come, you know, the supply is predetermined. So just wanted to make sure that we haven't spoken about this in terms of disclaimers. All this is not investment advice, right? You have all this in the disclaimers of the show later on, just to make sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, that could bring me on. I can just read the disclaimer for everyone again. You know, this space is for educational purposes only and is not investment advice. Past performance is not an indication of future results. All trading carries risks. Please do not risk capital you cannot afford to lose. So, yeah, thank you, Pedro, for reminding us there. Let us know in the chat how everyone is doing. Thumbs up if you're enjoying it. I know Simon has got an interesting question for Yoni, which is coming up right now.
Yes, we've got a question about tokenization. So we've seen last week BlackRock have entered the tokenization race with a new fund on the Ethereum blockchain. You're someone who's been very passionate about tokenization. What are your thoughts around it? How big can the space become? And what sort of time frame?
I think when we think of tokenization, we need to sort of split between the regulated space and the unregulated space. If we think of the entire crypto, let's call it meme mania, the 1,000 or 10,000 coins out there that act as a proxy for people investing in teams and ideas, very similar to VC investing, just structured in a different way that is more based on technology and much less on legal and sort of regulatory structure, right? So most crypto assets are not digital securities, they're not regulated. I think that space has already shown the impact of tokenization, and that's why we see 10,000 tokens, crypto coins, stable coins, etc. I think the holy grail of the financial services industry that everybody's watching and trying to figure out who's the winner and what's the path to success is when companies like BlackRock, NASDAQ, companies like Apollo, we've heard, Blackstone, all the large asset managers, all the large issuers and investors in traditional assets of alternatives, whether it's real estate or Hollywood or rights or soccer teams, we've seen every type of idea already surfacing in the 2017-18 rally. Then we've seen it again surfacing in 2021-2022 rally. I think the missing part there is infrastructure, which is required for connecting sort of real world assets to to digital assets and to digital securities. So I think there is a path forward, but the way I look at it, capital markets have always been a hyper-local capital markets. U.S. capital markets are U.S. capital markets with U.S. participants. German capital markets are German, and et cetera, et cetera. Every single country in the world has their own stock exchange, their own investment bankers, their own banking ecosystem, and a currency that's connected, and then investment advisors around that ecosystem. I think eventually we're seeing in the digital asset space a global capital markets forming, and that's going to take a while because there are a lot of interests of local players to keep local capital markets intact and not try and replace them with global and globally regulated capital markets. So I think we are going to see some interesting tokens and tokenization projects during 2024 and 2025. But for that to scale at the level of trillions, we're probably a couple of years away.
Very interesting. Pedro, Andrew, Francisco, anything to add?
Yeah, I have to say I quite agree with Yoni. I think tokenization is the way forward. But as a word of caution, all the big exchanges, all the big banks, this is a huge threat for them. So they don't want to turn into the yellow pages, and tokenization has that potential. So you're going to see them act aggressively and defensively. So I don't know how long it's going to take. I know the future is tokenization, but I think we're at the time of cowboys and Indians there. You know, it's way too early to tell who the winners will be. What I'm sure is that the JP Morgans of the world are not going to look at this without participating in the fight, or the New York Stock Exchanges or the Deutsche Börses and all that. You know, I'm sure they're quite aware. As asleep as they may be or pretend to be, I'm sure they're quite aware of the threat this represents to their business model.
Yeah, very interesting. I'll
give an example, which I think is interesting. One of the largest markets in the world is the bond market. The bond market, which includes government bonds, corporate bonds, is still very much even not digitized to E, right? So it's still hard. when we are now working to try and bring corporate bonds and treasury bonds of different countries into our customers in eToro, we're finding out that people are still buying bonds over the phone with the big banks. And the real reason for that is that the banks make money on the spreads, and the spreads are sometimes 0.5%, 1%. When you look at the stock market, where there was regulation that basically forced everyone to turn to E and to create the NBBO, the National Best Bid Best Offer in the US, it turned basically the spreads into, you know, what, or if you look at FX market, spreads are 1 pips or 1 to 5 pips in sophisticated electronic markets. And obviously tokenized markets will become electronic very fast because by nature, they're digitally native. And they're looking at how they make money from things like IPOs, private issuers, bond trading. And they're like, we're used to still selling financial assets over the phone based on relationships and then making 0.5% to sometimes 5% on a deal. And now if this entire world gets tokenized, that business doesn't exist anymore. And those are sort of very much conflicting interests. The majority of money in the world is right now running through those pipes. And those pipes are used to just much higher spreads and margins than what we see in the digital asset space.
Thank you very much, Yoni. We've also got in the chat listening along, quite a few of our eToro PIs, popular investors. Feel free to raise your hands to the room. It's great to have you all with us. We've actually been sent in a question talking about, is the main strategy here supply and demand, which actually brings me on to another guest speaker, I think, that could maybe answer this one. We're joined by our editor-in-chief at eToro, Matty Alon. Now, Matty, you're a value investor, right? So how would you answer this question? Because, you know, from a supply and demand point of view, this is your bread and butter, right?
Hey, Sam. Hey, everybody. I didn't think I'm going to attend this call, but I'll kill you later. Definitely a supply and demand, investment strategy. I mean, I saw the early investor in the crypto world was a big hedge fund manager that, you know, after that I met Pedro at actually Berkshire Hathaway meeting, and Pedro started in early days as a value investor, and then he starts speaking with me about this crypto, and I'm like, what are you talking about? Leave me alone. And I guess I was wrong, because Pedro was right. And I think the missing part that I was looking at, right? I mean, Yoni gave here his point of view and all the other guests, but from my perspective, it's really a pure, interesting supply and demand investment. Because by fact, and when we just did this marketing campaign about the halving, I realized, well, it's like a fact, just like what Pedro just said. It's a fact of something that, you know, the supply and demand game here is going to be in the favor of the crypto assets. But obviously, I mean, in supply and demand, like everything, it's to try and understand where, if it's imbalance, and if it's imbalance, so then it's your opportunity. If it's already overpriced, so maybe this is your risk. So I mean, you know, for me to come and say if it's imbalanced now, it's really hard. I guess the guys here that have the understanding of crypto, that they know it much better than I am. But I think the mix, from what I'm seeing recently, of the halving taking place at the same time that we have all the institutions, ETFs, and everything happening together, and I think Andrew actually addressed what I'm just saying, it's like, you know, it's everything comes together. And it's really hard to look at this halving as a pure halving play and ignore the ETF and the positive wind we get from there. So that's like my 2 cents.
question that we have, it's a bit left field, but I suppose we couldn't be on the crypto space without talking about them, is meme coins. What's everyone's opinion on meme coins? Are they a bit of fun, something that harms the crypto world, or something maybe in between?
So just quickly before we go to the meme coins, I think beyond just the supply and the demand, you know, equation here, I think increasingly with the geopolitical risk in the world, with the, you know, exuberant debt burden that's growing worldwide, with a lot of the tangential risks that are not direct related to Bitcoin, is moving that long tail, call it a lottery ticket, call it a insurance policy. People look at it differently, but it's moving that long tail risk or reward, whatever you want to, however you want to see it, inward, closer, you know, closer to being in the money, right? And so I think that there's an additional factor here beyond just the supply and the demand, which is, oh shit, the whole scenario for which Bitcoin was created in the first place, I can almost kind of see that coming on the horizon. And so maybe I want to have some of this. And I think more and more, a lot of people that I speak with that already own Bitcoin or that never owned Bitcoin are factoring that in to their math of maybe it's time to own some Bitcoin. And, you know, I've said to Pedro, I've said to many of my close friends that I can't explain to you why, but I have this very deep feeling that this cycle will be different, not just because of price or momentum or anything. I kind of do feel that we might be playing for all the chips. I think that this might be sort of the most important halving cycle yet, both because of the supply and the demand factors and the ETF compounding the halving event, as well as some of the existential risk. As far as meme coins, you know, I think they're fun. But I think, you know, look, none of these things, people talk about these massive market caps, but it's only because they're trading at the margin, right? And so, you know, somebody trades one coin out of 10 billion issuance, you know, for whatever price, and they suddenly say, oh, well, the market cap's $300 billion of this, you know, meme coin. So I think that ultimately they're dilutive. Everybody loves a casino, and this is just another one.
Yeah. Anyone else? Francisco, Pedro, anything you would add on that?
I just wanted to follow up on what Andrew said regarding the supply and demand. I think that basically what you mentioned is actually the interesting part here, because there is the really long term with the real point behind the viability of the cryptocurrency, which is basically, you know, the whole story behind the fiat currency and the debt of countries and you know, whatever you want to bring into it. And everything is right and interesting. But to me, it feels like now the retail investors and also institutional investors, not necessarily investing in that. I mean, the ones that really taking this approach are the ones like you guys, like Yoni, like Pedro, Andrew, and Francisco, and really, you know, buying for the long term because it's inevitable, right? But I think there is some of a big play here of the supply and demand. And by the way, if what you said is going to happen, and probably it's going to happen one day, that's just another layer of the supply and demand. That's what I just wanted to say. Pedro, I'm sure you have to say something about supply and demand on this side.
Well, absolutely. I think I just wanted to comment on what you're saying. You know, we at Nostr, we write a yearly update on what happened in Bitcoin so that we keep our investors abreast of what's going on. And the theme we had this year was, I wish I didn't have to own any Bitcoin. And it's true, you know, I wish the markets were functioning properly. But unfortunately, since 2009, since Bernanke changed the world by starting unconventional monetary policies that turn into totally accepted and conventional monetary policies nowadays. We started the long road to the terminal debasement of the major fiat currencies, namely the US dollar, the euro, the sterling. And as such, and as you alluded earlier, I used to be a value investor. I'm still a value investor at heart. But the problem I have is that everything is being debased. And at the same time, there's a huge trend into passive investing, which is killing value stocks, because every day there's 10,000 boomers who retire, they sell their mutual funds, they buy the SPY. So there's 500 stocks who are doing great and seven even better, and the rest of the market is completely orphan. So I had to own Bitcoin as a hedge against what was happening to the value universe in terms of demand. There was no demand, the demand is decreasing daily. And we had to find something that would protect us from the monetary debasement that started, well, it started in 71 when Nixon depegged the dollar from gold. It's been going at 7% a year on average. But since 2009, it's been turbocharged. And then 2012 comes Draghi and says whatever it takes. And, you know, I jokingly normally say that Satoshi Nakamoto is Bernanke, Draghi, Yellen and Kuroda, because they couldn't have done a better job for Bitcoin to thrive. So I'm just deeply saddened for the capital markets that the game is not that you have to own Bitcoin. There's no alternative, unfortunately.
I have to double down on that and agree. I think that on a macro level, even if you look at wider time horizons, I think debasement started in 71. But when we think of what we're seeing in the world is, you know, there are super cycles of 100 years where the base currency of the world changes. And when that happens, usually there's a very significant debasement to everything connected to the current one, which is the dollar. So I think Bitcoin is a hedge not only to the dollar, it's a hedge to anything that is dollar valued in your portfolio, which is a significant part of your portfolio. Because while I do hope we continue to see the dollar as the main currency of the world for the next 30 years, if you look at and read Ray Dalio's, where he looks at previous empires on 100-year cycles, then it does seem like we're coming to a point where there is the next cycle, and it's unclear in that cycle what is the base currency. I don't think necessarily Bitcoin is that base currency, but I think that might be our digital gold for the next maybe 100 years.
Very, very interesting. We're also joined, actually, by one of our PI, Stephen Budgeon. Now, you've always been a big advocate of crypto, at least as long as I've known yourself. How are you feeling at the moment? And do you have a question at all for our panel? Actually, I've just seen you are on, yes. Stephen, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Sam. Thanks very much for inviting me up to the stage to talk. I'm one of the popular investors at eToro. Just got a question for the panel, and I was just wondering, Sam, if you mind if I ask two really quick questions while I have
Absolutely.
The mic?
Absolutely. Go for it.
Okay. So my first question is, how do we expect the volatility to change in the Bitcoin market? Before, obviously, it was a very retail kind of led phenomenon where lots of retail investors were involved, not a lot of institutions were able to get involved because there was no ETFs, etc. How do we expect volatility to change as we go into the bull market? Because obviously, usually after the halving, maybe for a year or so, year to 18 months after the halving, we tend to see a rally. But how do we expect the volatility kind of to change towards the end of the cycle, when the prices are really high, before retail investors had tended to start to move their Bitcoin, sell their Bitcoin once it got to a certain price? Do we expect that to happen with these kind of seasoned hedge funds managers and institutions? That's question one. And then the second question I wanted to ask, what people expect on the panel from the FASB rules. The FASB rules are the accounting rules that are due to take place and change towards the end of 2024 for institutions to be able to buy Bitcoin and put it on their balance sheet. Do we expect lots of companies to take this up and start to buy Bitcoin on their balance sheet? And are there any further barriers in their way to stop them from to potentially dissuade them from doing this?
I can take a crack at those questions. So first on the volatility, there's a graph that I track daily, which graphs the volatility of Amazon since inception and its first 15 years versus the volatility of Bitcoin since inception, because they're both like exponential assets. They both were venture assets in the beginning, and the correlation is astounding. And funnily enough, like around 6 months ago, the volatility of Bitcoin is less than the volatility of Amazon when it was an asset of the same age. Now, going forward, as it matures as an asset, it's going to become less volatile overall. But that doesn't mean that you're not going to have an euphoria. And I think coming back to this halving and the fact that ETFs just launched and that we just opened the market to a whole new breed of investors, who are going to be victims to the same cycles of greed and fear as every other human. And so volatility might be exacerbated this cycle, and we might have a period towards the end of this year and most of next year in which volatility is a little bit above average. On your second question of FASB, I think it's great. You know, I think now it's legal for corporations to hold Bitcoin as a reserve asset, and which is great. I think in 2024, one of the major announcements and upsets of the market that I expect is for a sovereign state, and I mean like a G20 one, to announce that they've added Bitcoin. There's rumors in the market and that in the Middle East, there's already sovereigns participating. And I think that's huge. And to be quite honest, I think we're not too far from a central bank also announcing that, and I mean a G20 central bank announced that they've built Bitcoin into their reserve balances. And one thing that everybody needs to understand is that if you're not long Bitcoin, you're short Bitcoin. Because the day any of these announcements happens, it gaps up. You cannot hop on the train after the announcement. It's done. And the day that one country or one central bank announces that they've added Bitcoin as a reserve, it's going to be a game changer worldwide. So that's my crack at those two questions.
I'm happy to add as well. So one on volatility, I agree with the analysis. I think the bigger the market cap of an asset, the more mature an asset where it has a long and hold base of both retail and institutional, then volatility decreases over time. And you can see it if we launched Bitcoin prior to Mt. Gox at 1300, it went down to 150. Then it went to what was the top at 2018 or to the end of 2017, and then it went back. Yeah, 17,000 went back to 3,000. Then we had the next rally going to 65, 67, but then down to about 15. But it didn't, right? So if you look at that range, the range is going down of volatility from peak to valley, which makes sense on Bitcoin. We also need to remember that the last four rallies had sort of infused something that is leverage that doesn't exist, right? So you had Mt. Gox in 2013, you had the entire ICO market, which is printing money out of the air in 2017. You had all of the crypto lenders and all of the companies that issued
tokens of themselves and lending it to somebody else. And then we saw bankruptcies of about probably 20 large retail and non-retail platforms in 2021. So I think we're not seeing yet what's leveraging the market. By the way, maybe it's the ETFs, but there's always in every cycle something that looks extreme that leverages the entire market to a point where the bubble burst. And in crypto market, that cycle historically has been about 4 years, which coincides with the halving time cycle. In markets, it's usually about 10 years. And it also happens when we see sort of irrational exuberance and then sort of the markets dropping. Amazingly, we haven't seen it this time, despite the fact that we still have high interest rates. But that's because, as mentioned before, the rules have changed. The monetary policy, the printing of money has changed to support the asset values in dollars versus their real value or their PPP value. So I think volatility is going down of Bitcoin, definitely. But then if I'm going back to the previous question on meme coins are another example of what we've seen with ICOs, or another example of what we've seen with NFTs, which is people trying to take the concept of a deflationary asset like Bitcoin, saying, okay, and by the way, it's a very, very strong concept because only 21 million people in the world can own one Bitcoin, and there are 55 million millionaires. So a lot of people can still own one Bitcoin that for some reason haven't done it so far. And I think we are going to see that happening. And of course, if you then compound into that the fact that there can be only 100 firms who own X amount of Bitcoin, like a MicroStrategy for Fidelity. Bitcoin. So I think every time we're seeing meme coins, similar to what we've seen in NFTs, similar to what we've seen in ICOs, each cycle is a bit different. History doesn't repeat itself, but it definitely rhymes.
I love that.
If I can add to that, I mean, while Yoni was speaking, I was looking at 2022. I mean, we had an aggressive market drawdown, right? Now, you would come and say, hey, the crypto crashed, but actually, you know what? I'm looking at the Magnificent Seven. The drawdown was almost identical. The crypto was down 50%, Meta was down 49%, Google was down 47%. So it's not like the volatility or the drawdowns or these type of things. It's like what it used to be from, like what Yoni said, from 17,000 to 3,000, which is like a major thing. By the way, we've seen it also with Meta, for example, in 2022. So I think that shows, at least in the past 5 years, that we'd see some maturing market as well. I don't know if someone have any point on this.
Yeah, thank you, Matty.
I think you're spot on, Matty. Spot on. And there's one thing that I would complement that with. Even though it's the same volatility as the Mag 7, which one do you think is more likely to 10x from here? Bitcoin or the Mag 7 that are trading at exorbitant multiples?
Well, it depends if AI is going to continue at this pace. So I don't know.
Interesting. Very, very interesting indeed. We can take this conversation offline, I'm sure. Just as a reminder, as I mentioned earlier, Andrew, I'll come to you in a second. Just as a reminder to everyone listening, the whole conversation is going to be available online, also wherever you get your podcasts, under Digest and Invest by eToro. We believe heavily in education at eToro. You've got courses, you've got guides, you've got podcasts, you've got videos, all available on our eToro Academy. So please do remember to check that out, and obviously send us any messages after as well. Andrew, we'll come to you. What you're thinking?
Well, I was just going to say that I've just lost my train of thought.
Magnificent Seven, Bitcoin, 10 years time.
I mentioned at the beginning, my primary business is domain names. We're the top domain broker in the world. And one of the things that I say to my clients when they approach us with a domain, if it already has a website on it, you know, you'll understand why I say this. So if there's a website on it and I'm trying to sell your domain name as opposed to trying to sell a business, first question anybody asks is, well, does the business make money? How much money? And they want to value it on a multiple of the earnings, as anyone would do with a business. But when we're selling a raw domain name, it's a very different math. It's a commodity, so to speak, like Bitcoin. It's really, it becomes an emotional math. It becomes, how badly do you need it? How badly do you want it, right? As opposed to some vanilla multiple of earnings or revenue or traffic. It's a completely different animal in terms of price and value. And I think that, you know, you can't compare the Magnificent Seven with Bitcoin, because the Magnificent Seven are constrained to some degree. There is a universe in which they are constrained by earnings and growth. And that math can only go so far. Bitcoin is not constrained by any of those things. Bitcoin is constrained by adoption. And solely adoption. That is the only constraint on Bitcoin. The more people that understand what Bitcoin is, and the more people that have access to it, the higher the price of Bitcoin will go, because supply is fixed. So, yeah, it's not really a fair equation. I think Bitcoin is going to destroy the Magnificent Seven in terms of value growth, purely because it is an unconstrained asset. It's a commodity. It's not constrained by earnings or growth, just adoption.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much. And actually, that can bring us quite nicely to the end of today's session. Andrew, Francisco, Pedro, it's been an honor to have you on board, as of course it is Yoni and Matty, as well as my co-host Simon. Thank you so much for joining us today. Let us know in the chat if everyone else enjoyed it as well. As mentioned, you'll be able to find the recording online, whether that be on X or where you get your podcasts. But guys, thank you very much for joining today.
Likewise, thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye now.
Thank you. Thanks.
Take care, everyone. Enjoy the rest of your day and the rest of your week. You have been listening to Digest and Invest by eToro. For more information, use eToro.com. This podcast is for information and education purposes only and should not be taken as investment advice, a personal recommendation, or an offer of or solicitation to buy or sell any financial instruments. This material has been prepared without taking into account any particular recipient's investment objectives or financial situation, and has not been prepared in accordance with the legal and regulatory requirements to promote independent research. Past performance is not an indication of future results.